Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, October 2nd, 2020. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. On Thursday, game two of the series between the Atlanta Braves and the Cincinnati Reds. The Braves, of course, won game one, 1-0 in 13 innings. And you know what? Ian Anderson was terrific again for the Braves. He carried a shutout in the middle innings, and this happened for Atlanta in the bottom of the fifth.
There goes Riley. Here's the pitch, and it's lined toward the gap in left center field. That's in for a hit. It splits the defenders, rolls all the way to the wall. Riley around third. He will come in to score. Standing at second with an RBI double is Ronald Acuna. It's 1-0 Braves.
In the bottom of the eighth inning, the Braves put the game out of reach. Marcell Ozuna with a big hit.
The pitch hit in the air and hit well to left. Back is Goodwin looking up and waving goodbye. Two-run home run, Marcell Ozuna. And it's 3-0 Braves.
Yeah, from 680, the fan, the Braves would add a couple more runs. They win 5-0. The Reds do not score a run in the two-game series. After the game, Brian Snitker was asked about Marcell Ozuna stopping along the first baseline after he clubbed that home run and taking an imaginary selfie.
Nothing surprises me anymore. I mean, that's kind of the age we're in. I was like, you know what? I watch the highlights and I see guys strutting around. I see guys doing this and that. Doesn't even faze me anymore. It's where we're at in the game. You know what? I better deal with it because it ain't going away.
Ian Anderson, the Braves pitcher, threw six scoreless innings, and he talked about his struggles in the second inning and adapting.
That's kind of been my thing this year, I guess, so far. I have one kind of inning where I really have to battle and grind through it. And just the confidence you get from that just kind of propels you, you know, through the rest of the outing. And we made some great plays. Freddie catching that line drive was huge just for my confidence and for the situation that kind of unfolded.
Oakland and the White Sox, final game of the three-game set. Nomar Mazara added to the White Sox lead in the top of the third inning.
Mazara lines a ball to left center, and that's going to split the outfielders and get to the fence. Robert in to score easily. Mazara cruising into second with a double, and it is 3-0.
The unmistakable voice of Dan Schulman on ESPN Radio right there. But Oakland would start to come back in the bottom of the fourth.
1-0, and Murphy swings and drills one to left field. Back to the wall and gone. Sean Murphy with a deep drive to left, a two-run homer to get the A's on the board and make this one a lot more interesting.
And Rick Renteria, the manager of the White Sox, was making a bunch of pitching changes. He pulled Carlos Rodon with a couple runners on base for Matt Foster, who during the course of the year, 28 and two-thirds innings, 9 walks allowed. In this game, however, facing Mark Canha, Matt Olson, he lost the plate.
And the pitch, and he missed outside. Not close. Ball four to force in a run and tie the game. 3-1 on the way. Inside, ball four. Another bases-loaded walk, and the A's take the lead.
In the bottom of the fifth inning, it was tied 4-all. Chad Pinder at the plate.
The 0-1, and a swing, and a base hit into left field. In to score is Murphy. LaStella's on his way home, and he is safe at the plate. The swipe tag by Grandal doesn't get him. It's a two-run single, and the A's have a 6-4 lead.
Now, in the late innings, the White Sox mounted a couple rallies, but ninth inning, Liam Hendricks on the mound for Oakland.
The 2-2 pitch, and a fastball is there for strike three called, and the A's have won it. Hendricks strikes out of Mazara, and the A's are moving on. They'll take on Houston in the division series after a great performance in the ninth inning by Liam Hendricks.
And after the game, Liam Hendricks was asked about his emotions after playing for so long on Wednesday and then finishing out Thursday's game.
To be honest, I need a nap. 3 12-o'clock games in a row. We're throwing 50 pitches yesterday, and then it was tough. It's been hot out here. It's been humid. It's been a roller coaster of emotions. But I was just happy that I was able to kind of redeem myself after yesterday, not putting my best foot forward. And we've got a couple of days off. We'll head over to LA.
Bob Melvin talked about advancing in the postseason.
Yeah, I mean, not everybody's been part of all that. So, you know, we've had a couple of tough ones in the last 2 years. But, you know, the goal this year was try to get to a originally was win the division, try to get, you know, the first round off and then get to a series. So we got to a series, lost the first game and really responded well. So it was rewarding. Obviously we had to do a lot. I woke up this morning feeling like this is going to be a hard game, and it was a hard game. We had to use a lot of guys and had to make some uncomfortable decisions at times, but man, some guys really responded. So they're having a good time in there, as they should.
Dodgers Brewers, Clayton Kershaw pitching against Brandon Woodruff, and Clayton Kershaw had it going top of the fourth inning.
The 2-2 and a swing and a miss, got him with a slider. I'll tell you this, he's doing just fine tonight. Four scoreless innings with five strikeouts for Clayton Kershaw.
The Dodgers took a 3-0 lead. Kershaw was still on the mound in the top of the eighth inning.
3-0 Dodgers. And the 2-2 pitch on the way. Swing and a miss. He did throw him a slider, and he got him. And what an outstanding performance by Clayton Kershaw tonight. Maybe the end of the night, but eight scoreless innings with a new career high in the postseason. 13 punch-outs.
And after the Dodgers won 3-0, Clayton Kershaw was on with Scott Van Pelt talking about the win.
Yeah, I mean, it feels great to move on, you know, and start a five-game series, get to go to Dallas and play the winner of San Diego, St. Louis. We wanted to do that. We took care of business tonight, and it feels great to be a part of it, for sure.
You had the Bugs Bunny curve going tonight. I mean, this is not unusual for you, but when you have command of that pitch like that, how dangerous a weapon does that curveball specifically feel?
Yeah, it's important for me. Just, you know, my fastball and slider are very similar velocities. So to be able to throw a curveball in there, it's a lot slower, makes the hitters kind of have to adjust a little bit. And, you know, the Brewers tonight, they did a good job of laying off it down in the zone. And, you know, Braun wasn't in the lineup tonight. So I just tried to, you know, do the best I could and work with their way through their lineup.
Look, World Series are bust in the past postseasons. All of that, I'm sure you grow weary of hearing about. You can do nothing about it until you begin the process. And you've taken the first step. And now you mentioned Dallas. Like, that's, you're from there. I just wanted the mindset. It's such a strange setup. But for you personally, where do you feel like you are at the moment?
Yeah, it's going to be weird, man. You know, the good thing is everybody's going to have to deal with it. And for me personally, I live like 10 minutes from the hotel, right? I'm going to be staying in the bubble. So it's going to be weird. And I'll probably be able to see some family through a glass wall or something. But, you know, other than that, we got a job to do when we get down there. We know that it's only for a few weeks, and we're going to make the most of it.
Padres and Cardinals in San Diego. Cardinals won game one. And early on, it looked like the Cardinals were going to take control of game two.
The 0-2 is a swing and a high fly ball right field down into the corner. It's deep, and that ball is gone. A home run. Colton Wong, who only hit one during the season, has just belted a two-run homer for the St. Louis Cardinals here in the second inning.
And with Adam Wainwright on the mound, it probably felt pretty good for the Cardinals, but the Padres began to come back. It was 6-2, bottom of the sixth inning, two runners on base, and Fernando Tatis Jr. was at the plate.
Swing and a line shot. That's deep to left. That's back. That ball is gone. Home run. Fernando Tatis out of here in 0.2 seconds. A three-run homer and an absolute bullet here in San Diego. A three-run shot to make this a one-run game. It is 6-5.
Dave O'Brien on ESPN Radio. Manny Machado was next to the plate.
Swing, and there's a shot driven out to left field deep. It is gone, and this game is tied. The Padres on back-to-back blasts by Tatis Jr. and Manny Machado adds a whole new ball game.
In the bottom of the seventh inning, Will Myers hit a home run to give the Padres the lead, and then Tatis Jr. came to the plate with a runner on base.
3-2 coming. Swinging a shot to right field. That's deep. That's back. And that is gone again. Tatis Jr. strikes for his second consecutive at-bat. This is a two-run homer. In his last two at-bats, he's driven in five runs. And San Diego leads it 9-6.
And he gave an absolutely epic bat flip on that. We'll be talking about that coming up with Matt Viscursion. And here was the call in the ninth inning.
Swing and a ground ball to first. Up with it, Hosmer. He gets to the bag, and this one is over, and the Padres are still alive with a home run explosion, hitting five of them down the stretch of the ball game. They rally, and they knock off the St. Louis Cardinals 11-9, the final score.
And they will play game three of that series later today. Will Myers, Tatis Jr., talked about the comeback.
It was a lot of fun out there tonight, you know, especially being down one of our comeback wins. I think, you know, we've been doing that all year. And, you know, for the first game, I felt like we were pretty unlucky, especially from an offensive side. Same with the beginning of the game today. But, you know, it's only a matter of time for these bats really get going. And I felt like today we finally got going, got a big hit in the right time, and was able to keep that going. I think at that point, that's all we can really rely on. It's like, you know, we've hit all year, and, you know, we just got to wait for that time. Sometimes you're unlucky. We hit some balls really hard yesterday and even early in the game today. Had some things really not go our way. But, you know, I felt like tonight we finally turned that corner and was able to get some big hits when we needed and really rally.
I feel like we needed that big swing for the entire team to get us going. You know, we were missing a lot. We were running in scoring position, and I feel like that whoever did it first, we were gonna feed off of that. And you know, thank God I did it first. But I'm just happy that, you know, the team click, and we won the game.
So later today, two series still to be resolved. At 2 o'clock on ABC, the Miami Marlins and Cubs, who were rained out yesterday, will play game two of their series. And then at 7 o'clock Eastern on ESPN, the Cardinals against the San Diego Padres in game three of that series. Now, before we get to Matt Viskirjan and Todd Radom, check out the latest episode of the Mina Kimes Show. Mean and Field Yates discuss the fallout from the Ravens-Chiefs game, the Bears turning to Nick Foles, and whether or not we anointed Kyler Murray too early, who the best team in the NFC is, and which NFL players would be best at capture the flag. Download and subscribe to Mina Kimes Show wherever you get your podcast.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply. You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Matt Viskirjan is the play-by-play man on Sunday Night Baseball, and this week for a big part of the most voluminous day in baseball postseason history. Matt, how you holding up Friday morning? We don't have a game today.
Yeah, it's a very strange experience. I think I might turn the sound down on the Padres-Cardinals game and just do play-by-play myself, just because I've trained myself to do so many innings a day. No, you know, look, there are people that do jobs that are much more difficult than ours. So I'm not about to complain about workload, because after all, I do like it a lot too. So it was fun. It was cool to be a part of. I've got to explain to my wife and kids that I really don't want to talk much today. Like, you know, I came home last night and it's, hey, what about this? Can you do this? I'm like, can you ask me questions that I can give you nonverbal responses? Can I Can I just like, can I like a horse? One means yes, two means no, because I just don't want to say anything anymore. But it was fun to be a part of that for sure. And we had some really interesting, albeit long, games to discuss.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a moment. On that that Wednesday, you called 765 pitches in those two games that we had. But first, let's start with this from the games from last night. Do you want to go young or old? And obviously, that's going to mean Padres or Dodgers.
Let's start with the young. Let's start with the young and the inevitable conversation, I guess, around the Tatis bat flip. is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, and we'll get to that first. I mean, last night, as you're watching that game, we'll start with the Padres against the Cardinals. I got to say, you know, when I first saw the Cardinals take the lead with a young Padre team, I thought, okay, well, that's it. But, man, they punched back.
They did. I thought they were cooked. And, you know, certainly the Cardinals' bullpen played a role in that, too. They fell apart late. And I thought Wainwright was going to be out there for a little bit longer. And I thought we were going to get vintage Wainwright the same way we got vintage Kershaw in the other NL game yesterday. But the Padres are a different animal. And, you know, whether or not that Tatis homer really did something to kind of enliven the rest of the dugout and change the flow of the game or not, we'll never know. But I think this, when a guy like that hits a homer in an empty ballpark, it actually played differently than it would have if there were 38,000 fans there. The crowd noise would have been deafening. It would have been, the energy would have been amazing. But at this point, you and I have talked about this. When a guy like that hits a homer in a situation like that, it's strictly for his team. It's for the other 26 players in the clubhouse and the coaching staff. And I think the energy swell without fans was more acute in the clubhouse because of that. I almost contrarian thought there. I know it doesn't make much sense to the eye test, but I just felt like that moment was so big for those guys and nobody else. They're doing it for themselves now, and there's no fan participation at all. I wish there was. I'm not saying that's the right way, but what a big moment that was for them. And you can't count them out. Even though Flaherty goes in game three, you can't count the Padres out because they've got something that's hard to define this year.
I completely agree with you. You know, we've talked a lot about having the games without fans in the stands, and there's no question the players have suffered, their performance has suffered in a lot of cases because of the lack of energy. But I feel like the home runs are the outliers because, and I've really actually enjoyed the sounds of the dugouts of the players who hit the home runs to listen to that. You know, I told you that, you know, like being in Yankee Stadium out in center field, I think it was Aaron Judge who hit a home run, and I could hear the Yankees dugout erupt from where my position was in center field, even when the ball probably was just getting out of the infield, because those guys knew first, and it felt like that yesterday. And it's sort of like the difference, you know, if you have fans in the stands, that moment, it's going to feel like if it was a boxing match, they had gloves on. Without fans in the stands, because the other dugout can hear it, it's like a bare-knuckle brawl. Like,
yes,
I mean, it's got to hurt a little bit more if you're on the other side of the field.
Yeah, that's a great comp. And I think that's why, you know, players' noses have been pushed out of shape at various stages in this odd year because of that very dynamic you discussed. And you know, you can hear everything. And there's that possibility that somebody is going to misinterpret something and think that it's been directed their way when in fact it wasn't. And that's why I don't really have a problem with the Tatis flip, because as soon as he did it, he was looking right into his dugout. That was for his guys. That I get it. You know, you're doing it against in a postseason game and the other team can take offense, but to me, there was no offense to be taken there. If he was looking into the St. Louis dugout, completely different story. But he was looking at his guys when he did that.
And that's the same thing with Marcell Ozuna. To me, anyway, you know, he did the selfie celebration halfway up the first baseline. I didn't have a chance this morning to go through the papers to see if any Reds player was complaining about it. I doubt they did because they were so utterly dominated in these 2 days, and it would have felt kind of weak. But I kind of didn't have a problem with that either, because it was all about his team, about him, about their situation, and not trying to show up the other guys.
I agree. You know, and he's got a reputation too as being a fun-loving guy. Yeah, one of those kind of one of those big personalities that, you know, people that know of him and know him probably would give him a break in that regard. If it was a guy that nobody knew anything about, maybe somebody's nose would be pushed out of shape. But I think I'm with you on that. I took no offense in that one either.
You got any feel for game three? Gut feeling on Padres Cardinals?
My gut feeling is that it's going to play out the way yesterday's did, in that there's going to be a lot of runs because there's going to be a very short leash. Flaherty, by comparison to last year and even the previous year, has been a little uneven. You know, I mean, he's a blue blood for sure. Like, the guy is a stud. But in an elimination game, when a guy gets into a little trouble and a manager is tempted to open that bullpen gate earlier than he ordinarily would, that means the whole thing gets backed up. That means everybody's going to pitch. I see another high scoring game today, and I have no idea which way it's going to break.
All right, what'd you think about Clayton Kershaw last night?
I don't want to be one of these, you know, I told you so guys, but I was having discussions with people yesterday via text, and I felt like last night was going to be dominant Clayton Kershaw, vintage Kershaw, which it was for a number of reasons. You know, it's a Brewers team that can strike out. Kershaw's postseasons, and he's, you know, again, he's been criticized for them, I think unfairly so. They don't start out badly. Division series games, early matchups with teams that aren't World Series caliber, and I don't think any of us would consider the Brewers a World Series caliber team this year, that's when he lights it up. I mean, those are akin to those mid-June games on a marine layer night at Dodger Stadium when an injured Rockies lineup limps into town when Kershaw strikes out 13. I mean, he was brilliant last night. And boy, did he make things easy for Dave Roberts. There was no worrying about how are we going to get it to Jansen? Are we going to get it to Jansen? What kind of Jansen do we get in this one? He just took the whole thing by himself. And man, what a positive thing that is for the Dodgers moving forward. If they can get 80% of what they had from Kershaw yesterday for the rest of the run, they're not going to be slowed down by anybody. So I wasn't surprised by it. I was pleased by it because I'm glad he had that kind of night. He deserves a positive postseason review, and he certainly is getting them after yesterday. And, you know, here come the Dodgers. They're everything that we thought they'd be.
And I think Kershaw and what he's done in this 60-game season underscores what I've always thought was missed by analytics. And I've had this, you know, discussion with a lot of folks, including our friend Boog Shambi. We disagree on things, and I always say, Boog, none of those numbers really mean anything if the player changes. If the player makes substantive changes in what he's doing, then that all that the past information really doesn't matter. We saw that thing, the same type of development with Justin Verlander like 3-4 years ago, where, you know, when he began to get hit a little bit, Brad Ausmus calls him into his office when he was with the Tigers. Hey, you really need to start looking at some scouting reports. Check out this stuff. And Verlander goes from bullying hitters to using the information and to getting better. And then, you know, he goes to Houston, a different pitch mix, and he gets better. And that's what's been fun about Kershaw this year.
Yeah, a different pitch mix and a different plan. So if a guy's strikeouts per nine are down and on the decline, then the corollary number is, well, how many pitches per plate appearance is he averaging? Because if that number's lower as well, then he's going about it differently, and he's trying to get rid of contact and get opponents to hit the ball on the ground. And that's a small part of Kershaw's evolution. I agree with you. I think that's a well-taken point. You can't continue to judge older pitchers, especially pitchers that have had success, the same way you judge them 5 years ago if they've changed the way they go about their craft. That's a very fair point. And analytically, if you're going to look at Kershaw analytically and start taking issue with some of the results, you're just missing the point. They win when he takes the ball. That's the most important thing, and they proved that again last night.
What'd you make of Dave going with Gratterall in the ninth inning? I thought that was really interesting.
It's the beginning of that. I firmly believe that. Like, they're slow playing that, and they're not going to talk about it because they don't want to disrespect Kenley, and that's a very honorable way to go. But Gratterall's the closer of the future there. I mean, he might be the closer of the right now. We might see the rest of the postseason that way. I think there'll be moments where Kenley gets a ninth, but based on leverage, based on the part of the lineup that's due up, I mean, I don't know about you, but if I'm a Dodger fan, I feel a little bit more comfortable with Gratterall right now.
Yeah, and you and I have talked about this, and I think it's off air, but I can't imagine having a better personality to be a closer than what Gratterall has. Maybe we talked about the last time you were on the podcast. I just, you know, you watch him, and he just acts like no pressure at all. He just goes out there and has fun.
Yeah, for sure. The closer that overprocesses is the guy that stumbles. And quite frankly, I was a little worried about Hendricks in that regard. He is a fun-loving guy, and he is pretty loose and easy. But when you have a clunker like he did in game two when he was asked to get six outs, and man, that still makes me scratch my head. And then you bring him back in an elimination game with a two-run lead the following day to face the heart of the order. I mean, there were moments, admittedly, where I was driving home listening to the game on the radio. I actually made a phone call during the ninth because I was having a hard time processing I was having Billy Koch flashbacks. I mean, as an A's fan, the PTSD is real. But he held, and the A's move on. And I know that the other side of that is for White Sox fans, they felt like that whole game three was mishandled to a degree with pitching decisions. I get that. I get the complaint. But at the end of the day, they walked nine. Like, the White Sox staff walked nine.
Right.
So the players have to share some responsibility and performance there. And this is classic postseason overcooking. And we saw it in that Yankees-Indians game. The walks were insane. And it's, you know, the Yankees start to get their mojo back. The Indians are a little afraid of it, understandably. So they start to cherry pick. Those at-bats get too long, the walk total rises, and it turns into almost an unrecognizably bad brand of baseball that, unfortunately, we've seen all too much of in the postseason in the recent past.
I want to double back a little bit and just follow up because you are well-established as an Oakland Athletics fan. How relieved are you for that group of people in that organization to have won that game? They snapped the Major League Baseball record, 9-game losing streak and winner-take-all games dating back to Game 7 of the 1973 World Series.
Insane. I mean, it's insane to think about that. It really is. And there have been so many. I mean, the Jeter flip play, we could go on and on. Maglio Ordonez, all these postseason nemesis and all these moments that kind of get you. Yandy Diaz last year, Judge the year before that. I am pleased for that group. Bob Melvin deserves a ton of credit because I can't think of a manager who balances what comes downhill to him from the front office with what he believes to be correct with the desires of his team, his players, better than Bob Melvin. Got stuff coming from the analytics guys who were very powerful in that organization, as we know. He's got a lot of dirt in his spikes. I mean, he was raised at the foot of Roger Craig and the Hum Baby brand of baseball that he was kind of bred into with the early 80s Giants. He's got his own ideas, and he wants to take care of his players, and he does such a magnificent job in that. And at some point, I guess the world will recognize that. Baseball will recognize that more so than just a small slice of A's fans that think as highly of him as I do. But man, it's very refreshing. It's encouraging that they were able to get past the first round. And think about 1973. I mean, my goodness, Game 7 of the World Series that year. That is a ridiculous amount of time to have not won a postseason elimination game between now and then. Like, tell that to the Twins, I get it, or even the Reds, who are, you know, in the midst of a little mini postseason crisis right now. But it's very satisfying for the A's, and I'm pleased for Bob Melvin specifically.
You got a gut feel on that Oakland-Houston series? Because that could be fun. That will be fun, I should say.
You know, I feel the Oakland-Houston series, I feel about the Astros in a similar sense that I feel about the Braves. And this is, I'm taking my broadcaster ESPN cap off. This is Matt, the baseball fan here. When you get past the Braves' front two starters, and we saw them and they were spectacular this week, Fried and Anderson, I'm not sure how confident you can be. And yes, Kyle Wright was better down the stretch, but young guy, super short sample size of being good. We're only talking about the month of September, three starts. And I kind of think the same way about the Astros right now. And the Astros spent all their good bullets to take care of the Twins in a very timely manner, the same way the Braves did it. Once you get into that next layer of pitching, whether it's a third or fourth starter or your non-A group out of the bullpen, what's there? So for the A's, they've handled the Astros all year. There are no secrets there. And as you know, that organization, the A's, had been complaining about some of the chicanery going on in Houston for a long, long time.
Yep.
And it fell on deaf ears at the league office, and shame on everybody for not paying attention, because as it turns out, those complaints were correct. So the A's have a thing for the Astros more so than the Dodgers, more so than any other team in baseball, because that they were in their way for years atop the division. Oakland felt like they were a better team than Houston, and they felt like the difference was some of the unethical things that were going on there that have been well documented between now and then. So the A's are extra motivated for this. They've handled them all year, and I think they're probably a more complete team than the Astros. But again, you know where my fandom lies, so I am absolutely biased when I make that statement.
Yeah, and keep in mind, the division series this year is going to be played on consecutive days, which will really expose what you're talking about, the pitching depth, and we'll see if that's difference-making. Just to double back also real quick, Rick Renteria's decision to bring in Matt Foster. He walks a couple guys, a couple runs score. I remember during one of the Giants championship runs, going up to Bruce Bochy, who I knew from my San Diego days, and we were friends, and I walked up to him. It's like, "Boch, I'm trying to keep track. Today, are you an absolute genius or are you a complete idiot?" Because it felt like every day, every decision was always viewed through the portal of the result. And I've always thought that's unfair once we get into the postseason. I thought your point before about, walking nine guys for the entire pitching staff, that's dead on. And if you look at this, like Matt Foster, during the regular season, 23 games, 28 and two-thirds innings, nine walks in 28 and two-thirds innings. You're not putting him in the game thinking that all of a sudden he's going to be Bert Hooten back in the 77 playoffs, losing the strike zone and kind of getting freaked out. Johnny Cueto in Pittsburgh, you're not thinking that's what's going to happen. I don't really have a problem with the decision. Maybe Rick was a little aggressive in how he was deploying pitchers early on, but it's not like those guys, were out on the mound without an opportunity to succeed.
That's absolutely correct. And, look, at some point the player has to execute, right? You're on the roster for a reason. They've made the move to you for a reason. The Bochy example is great because I remember Bochy being criticized pretty roundly for going to Donnie Wahl in game one of the 1998 World Series against the Yankees. The move to Donnie Wahl wasn't the problem. Donnie Wahl didn't execute. That was part of the problem. And let's face it, the Padres were probably outmanned anyway. So when a manager rolls the dice, whether it's a gut feeling or something that's completely analytically sound and the player doesn't execute, it's the player. It's not the manager. It's the player. And people aren't willing to really come to grips with that, certainly, because we're in a player-first culture as fans. But Rick could take some criticism for the aggressiveness with which he handled his bullpen. You mentioned that overriding principle. But at some point, look, if he'd gotten a ground ball there, then he's a genius for making that move. That's all there is to it.
All right, before you go, just take me back through on Wednesday. As that day is playing out, we were late in our first game that wound up going 13 innings with the Braves beating the Reds 1-0 during commercial break. You were saying you knew it was going to happen this way. You knew it was going to happen this way. This first game would run long. And then the second game, you knew it also run long. But we also had, 76 minutes of rain delays in the middle of that.
Yeah, 76 minutes of phantom. Well, the first one, at least, was a phantom inexplicable rain delay, which reminded us all of that phantom Tigers game in a recent post. It was that 2012 when they banged a game. Was it Tigers Yankees? They banged the entire division series game or LCS game, and it was clear skies the entire night. Like, the technology exists for us to look at the radar and tell if there's weather coming. How did that happen? And I get it, with our game, with that Yankees Indians game the other night, and I believe it was Carl Willis that explained it to us. The wind conditions there are such that it can change pretty quickly. So somebody made the decision to delay the start, and then the pattern changed and it made everybody look kind of bad. But back to your earlier point, if it can go wrong, it will go wrong. And for us to think that we could get these wild card series rounds in these nice clean 3-hour windows, we've all watched enough postseason baseball over the years. Not only is that time date stamp incorrect, it's incorrect by about an hour. They're 4-hour games, even when things go smoothly. They play differently. There are deeper counts. There are stress pitches. There is more time between pitches. There's a little bit more time during commercial, but I'm not going to assign that as the reason, the whole sole reason that these games go long. They're 4-hour games. So if you're trying to stack them up the way baseball was this week with 8 in a day, you just have to expect that they're going to go long and it's going to get hairy, which it did, but it was still a ton of fun.
Oh, it was so much fun. I did feel bad for you at the end of it because, of course, I'm working from my home studio and we finished up with that Yankee and Indian game after 1 o'clock in the morning and my camera goes off and I'm in bed within 30 seconds. You, on the other hand, you got to get up and then get up the next morning. So great job by you getting us through that day.
I visualize you like John Clayton in that old ESPN commercial where as soon as you're done with your hit, you turn on the heavy metal music and you let your hair down and you flop on the bed. But in your case, it was just put the pajamas on and you were probably asleep within 5 minutes.
I did the game in pajamas. I think I put the pajamas on before we got to the second game. All right, Matt, thank you.
All right, Buster.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world. Todd, how you doing this week?
Hanging in there, Buster. How are you?
Hanging in there. And, normally we go into a conversation about a ballpark. We've got our last ballpark this week to talk about, Target Field in Minnesota. But I saw something on Twitter this morning from Dan Joseph. And the first person I thought of was you. I thought you would have a lot of fun breaking this down. It is apparently audio from a radio show in 1932, right after the conclusion of the 1932 World Series in which the Yankees destroyed the Cubs. And in that World Series, Babe Ruth did or didn't call his shot with a home run off Charlie Root. And this is Lou Gehrig in October of 1932 describing what happened in this interview. Give a listen.
The Babe and I got back to town an hour ago from an all-day fishing trip out on the south shore of the Long Island Sound. Between weakfish, the gang did a lot of reminiscing about the series, and everybody agreed that the high point of the whole works was Babe's homer in the fifth inning of the third game out in Chicago. I've played a lot of baseball, but I have never seen so much nerve on display before. Babe had two strikes on him. There were 50,000 Cub fans giving him the old Bronx cheer. And the Cub players were riding him from the field. So what does he do? He stands up there and tells the world that he's going to sack that next one. And not only that, but he tells the world right where he's going to sock it, into the center field stand. A few seconds later, the ball was just where he pointed, in the center field stand. He called his shot and then made it. I ask you, what can you do with a guy like that?
So what do you think, Todd? We heard it right from Lou Gehrig, who was in the on-deck circle for that home run.
Buster, it's amazing, first of all, that New York accent on Lou Gehrig. I mean, just, right? Hearing the clarity of that and this moment that's been shrouded in mystery since 1932. Did he? Didn't he? Did he? Was it right? I mean, I don't know if we could say definitively that he did, even after having heard that, but I'm certainly one step closer to thinking that he called his shot. How do you feel?
No, I don't believe it at all.
You think it was just this contrived radio speak? I mean,
yeah, because you and I both know he was working from a script right there. It wasn't like he was working off the cuff. Somebody wrote a script for him, and it was like, you know what? We have to embed this legend here. Lou, can you please read this? Are you? Oh. No? Am I too cynical?
You are. What a cynic. It's Lou Gehrig, the purest man, you know, a very honest guy by all accounts. Someone who was ethical in his deal. I don't know, Buster. I'm that much closer to thinking it. But I'm not going to, you know, I can't commit to it. And let's face it, there are very few people alive, if anyone, who was actually there. But like I said, I'm a little closer to it. Just a little.
Okay. Well, Taylor, you get to be the tiebreaker today. You heard Lou Gehrig's description, or the description written for Lou Gehrig, of what happened during the 1932 World Series. How are you feeling about it?
It definitely, obviously scripted, but I believe him. I buy it for sure.
Wow.
So he was a couple of feet Buster. Away, standing in the on-deck circle.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I don't know when this was like, when this came out that, you know, the legend of him calling a shot, but I buy it. Sure.
Yeah, well, it was written that day, and there were references to it, and we've all seen the video of it where he seems to be jabbing a finger in the direction of Charlie Root or in center field, if you are a true believer. I've never been a true believer in this. That seems way too incredible. I think if he meant to say center field, he would have extended his arm. But and so to hear Lou Gehrig's voice is awesome, and it doesn't move me at all. So sorry about that.
Sad.
Wow. All right. Well, you know, again, we'll never know. And, you know, I'm a firm believer, guys, in the absolute fact that some mysteries are best left unsolved.
There you go. It is like the Loch Ness Monster. All right. Let's talk about Target Field in Minnesota.
Target Field, Buster. I mean, I find it in thinking about Target Field, you got to start at the beginning and how it was created and why it was created. And we kind of forget that the club was slated to be contracted by Major League Baseball. There were rumors and, you know, a vote to build a ballpark in North Carolina that the club was going to move to. It never happened. But the Twins survived. And all these years later, Target Field is here, built in opened in 2010, a ballpark that literally was 15 years in the making. And I have to say, you know, this is one of my favorite parks in the majors. I'm going to go down some reasons why, and we can talk with you about the utility of the escalators or the press box there and all this. But Target Field, Buster, is a jewel in downtown Minneapolis. I love the fact that it's directly connected to the city, as very few other ballparks are. It's probably the most urban park in all of MLB. Probably, you know, on a par, certainly, with Wrigley and, you know, with Fenway. A couple of design features. I mean, it's fascinating to me. This ballpark was shoehorned into a tiny 8-acre footprint, which is actually smaller than that of Fenway Park. So they literally built up and out around and atop a highway, a series of bus and car ramps. And, you know, the effect really is that it is integrated completely into the city, wedged in right next to an industrial-sized municipal trash burner. How about that for a unique aspect for ballpark, right? it is a startlingly modern design, and it has a couple of very signature elements. We talk about these signature elements. First of all, you've got to look to that metal canopy roof, which is really quite striking. It is comprised of, you know, throughout the ballpark, you see all that beautiful local Minnesota limestone, including on top of the dugouts, right, which is a pretty unique thing. I love the fact that some of the seats are actually made of wood, like, you know, first time since who knows when. I love the gigantic Minnie and Paul neon sign out in center field. And Buster, I will say that maybe the most unique thing that I have personally experienced about Target Field, and I've been there many times, is I went and did a ballpark tour out there in anticipation of the 2014 All-Star Game. And I have stood out in left field. Out in left field, you're standing there. Imagine being the Twins left fielder. And you can hear the clanging bells from the light rail located just several feet directly behind you. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I love going to that ballpark. It's not in my top 10, but I, you know, the times I've gone there and worked there, it's easy. The people are always great. I mean, the whole thing about Minnesota nice is not overstated. I've always, you know, when I've gone there, I think it's a beautiful place. Remember doing the Home Run Derby there, Giancarlo Stanton putting on an absolute show. Yep. In the year they had that, and that was really cool. I was going to mention the Metrodome, which was the ballpark before that. I never went to, you know, the Met, which is where the Vikings and the Twins played way back. But I did go covered a lot of games in the Metrodome. And my most outstanding memory of that time was actually the fact that the umpire's dressing room was right next to the visitor's clubhouse. And so I remember there was a play at second base that involved a young umpire at that time, Angel Hernandez.
Oh, boy.
And I knocked on the door, and I just asked the crew chief. I said, I want to ask Angel about a call. And what I got from the back was, get the F out of here. Get the – and just boom, just laying me out. Like, Angel had no interest in discussing his call. But the nice thing was, the utility of the Metrodome, I could just walk 6 feet to the right and go right into the visitor's clubhouse. But that's my great memory from the Metrodome.
That's a great story. I have to say, I only went to one game at the Metrodome, and it was weird. It was in April of 1991, so this is a year that the Twins would go on to win the World Series, the most recent time that they won the Fall Classic. And it was a rainy, just raw Minnesota day in April, and we are comfortably indoors. You could see through that roof because, you know, it was a day game. And just so strange. And, of course, the Minnesota Vikings, gigantic glassy stadium is there. I actually stayed out there at a hotel just a couple of blocks away from there last September. Amazing. And, yeah, the Met, same thing with me. I have never been there, but I have been to the Mall of America, Buster. And they do have a home plate embedded in the ground in the mall where home plate at the Met was.
Yeah, I've been there, too. It's very cool. And I think, you know, think of guys like Harmon Killebrew and Jim Cotton. Very cool.
Rod Carew celebrated a 75th birthday yesterday.
Yeah, there you go. All right, let's get to this week's quiz.
All right, guys, here we go. This ballpark is the oldest among the five National League East stadiums. Is it Citizens Bank Park in Philadelphia? Is it Citi Field? Is it Nationals Park? Or is it Marlins Park? Of these, which is the oldest? We know it's not Atlanta. So is it Citizens Bank Park, Citi Field, Nationals Park, or Marlins Park, oldest in the NL East?
All right. Taylor, what you got?
Got to be Citizens Bank, right?
Yeah, Citizens Bank.
Wow, you're both right. You're both right. 2004.
Another draw.
Not a lot of opportunity or situations this year when we both got the answer right. That's for sure. Especially me. Has not been a stellar year. I'm already in the process of assessing my on-field personnel, my front office, and we'll have announcements soon. all right, Todd. All right, Todd, thank you again. Before you go, we know that your book, Winning Ugly, is being released in paperback. Tell us more about that.
Yes, Buster, thank you. It is my loving homage to some of the most questionable, air quotes, uniforms in the history of Major League Baseball. It is an essay on the history of the baseball uniforms and why the Cincinnati Reds, who just went bye-bye, look somewhat like the Cincinnati Red Stockings of 1869. It is out there, available wherever books are sold. A gift for any baseball fan, and everybody loves the uniforms.
And it's one of my son's favorite books. He has it there. He's got about 10 books in his bookcase in his room, and that's one of them, Todd. You see him poking through it all the time. Awesome. All right, sir.
All right, guys. Thanks.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher tweets for Friday coming up. First up, we got T. Jones at TNJ629. He writes, and Buster, it seems that lots of strikes at the corners of the zone are called balls, and the announcers seemingly have no problem with it. Are those the pitches that are preventing the automated strike zone from being implemented?
No, and I would disagree with that assessment. I think anytime that it's called a ball and it's actually a strike or vice versa, I think the announcers will note it. Certainly, the team that's affected is going to note it as well. I think what's preventing the automated strike zone is an agreement at some point between the union and Major League Baseball, the umpires union. And there are bigger picture concerns, I think, for baseball if they actually implement it. It'll certainly minimize the importance of catching in the way that it has been in the past, and I think the Player Association might have something to say about that.
Next up, we got Ben Swinerton, not sure. He writes, pinch running seems to be contrary to analytics. Is such a move dictated by the front office, or do managers do that on their own?
Yeah, and they're very, we saw some situations when there was pinch running. Look, I think that for the most part, as I'm reading the question, I can't think of a situation in any team, in any organization, where the manager and the front office are separate. Like, they work in concert with a lot of it, as Matt described, coming down from the front office. I think in individual situations, maybe occasionally you see a manager go gut feel, but most of the time it's something they've discussed beforehand.
Last one for today, PK Steinberg. He writes in, Buster, what is it about play-by-play that doesn't interest you? And this is in response to Dan Shulman yesterday saying he tried to get you to do a little bit when you guys worked together, but you declined.
Yeah, I'm just going to quote Clint Eastwood's line, a man's got to know his limitations, okay?
All right, fair enough.
Especially when you work for years with someone who has a voice as great as Dan's voice is. I'm not touching that. Like, I'm not going to be the guy. That's like stepping in, you know, on a given day. Hey, you're going to be the center fielder for the Angels in place of Mike Trout. No, thank you.
All right. Thanks for writing in, everyone. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Keep them coming and enjoy the baseball over the weekend.
Yeah, it should be a fun day today. I'm excited for the game, especially the Padres-Cardinals game later tonight. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. My thanks to Matt, Todd, and Taylor. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight. The podcast.